From KCUR Studios, this is Statehouse Blend Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. It's a weekly podcast where we bring you the politics and policy that's happening at the Capitol, where we meet the people making the news and figure out why it matters for our lives. This week, we're talking with the state's newest ex-senator, Ryan Silvey, newly enshrined as a member of the Public Service Commission. Today, something of an exit interview with this Republican who often clashed with a governor, who just a week after nominating Silvey to the new post, found himself very much on the rocks, admitting to an affair before his election and accused of threatening to distribute a naked photograph of the woman if she talked. He denies that. We'll get the latest on all that, but first this week in Jefferson City. The House has passed its first three bills of the year, sending them over to the Senate. One seeks to combat human trafficking, one would reduce the regulations on hair braiding, and one bans most gifts from lobbyists to elected officials. Sponsor Justin Alferman, a Republican from Herman, heralded the bill's mundanity.
It is literally the exact same version of the bill that this entire body voted on last year. That vote had only five dissenting votes. There should be no surprises in this bill for anybody.
It passed again this year, but its prospects are unclear in the Senate, where it died last year and the year before. Still, the action in the House seems to prove the argument of some legislative leaders that all the controversy over Governor Greitens' personal conduct isn't keeping them from doing their jobs. Here's the Senate President pro tem, Ron Richard.
I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I've been in leadership on both sides of this building. There's distractions in the building, outside the building. Rest assured, I've been through troubled waters before and I can steer it again.
Maybe, but not everyone is rowing the same direction. Numerous Democrats turned up the volume on their calls for Greitens to resign this week, and five Republican lawmakers joined them, including Senator Rob Schaff, whose personal cell phone was once shared on social media by the governor's supporters who were angry with him. Here he was on the floor of the Senate this week.
The most important thing is that the people of Missouri must be able to have confidence in their government. But given everything that's happened, they might forgive, but they won't forget. So, Governor, I'm asking you, please resign.
For his part, the governor gave his first interview since all this came out this weekend. He told the Associated Press that there was no violence and no blackmail, although he would not confirm or deny whether he bound the woman and took her photo while she was blindfolded. He did say this was the only affair and that his marriage to First Lady Sheena Greitens is, quote, strong. He also said he won't resign. One person missing from the halls of the Capitol during all this was Ryan Silvey, unanimously confirmed 2 weeks before to the Public Service Commission, where he's already at work. Commissioner Ryan Silvey, welcome to Statehouse Blend.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here. And also joining us is my KCUR colleague, our morning newscaster, Kyle Palmer. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. So, Commissioner Silvey, do you miss the Senate yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it all happened so fast, and I didn't really have a whole lot of time to fully process the decision, but, four of the five commissioners are former senators, so I've got plenty of support to lean on.
I mean, you say it happened so fast. How fast did it happen? Were you told you have 72 hours or something to make a decision?
No, so apparently, I think it's the fastest in history, is what we've been told. And then literally they appointed me Tuesday night and I was confirmed Thursday morning. So 40 hours, I think, from appointment to confirmation.
Yeah. In what state do you feel like you're leaving the General Assembly and the Senate, considering what's happened over the last week or two?
Well, certainly that all happened after I was,
after I was
confirmed. So that was a shock. They're gonna figure it out. You know, I mean, there's not a whole lot that normally goes on the first couple of weeks of session. So it hasn't been a huge distraction probably yet because there's not a whole lot going on.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out.
Right.
I mean, were you a little surprised? You and the governor have, as has been well reported, have had your differences.
Sure.
You've talked about them here. Why do you think he asked you to do this?
Sure. I mean, I was surprised as anybody. I mean, it's not certainly something I had asked for or pursued. I think there's a couple reasons. One, while the governor and I have clashed on a number of areas, energy policy is not one of them. And having been chairman of the Utilities Committee, when that term expired of Commissioner Stoll, they were looking for someone to replace. And I would like to think that my skill set played into part of that decision. But clearly, I think that part of it, too, was because I had been such a thorn in the side, that if if I would accept this and move over, then that's one less distraction for them.
And why did you say yes? I mean, you loved, if I may say so, you loved being in the Senate.
I did. Term limits is a big part of it. I had 3 years left to affect public policy in the state. After that, I could have run for various things, but those are always a coin flip at best. I mean, you're never guaranteed to win any race that you enter. This is a six-year term. It's an area of policy that I'm very interested in. I think it's a rapidly evolving sector of the economy, and it essentially doubles the time that I'll be able to affect policy.
Now, I will say, I mean, I've read some interviews with you immediately after the appointment and the nomination, and you kind of shifted away from, you know, any kind of reading into why the governor would have appointed you or asked for your nomination. But it seems now that, you're kind of at least that's part of the reason, right, that there was those clashes between you and the governor, and that played a role.
I would imagine. I mean, they never told me that. But, I mean, I've been around politics long enough to know that it would be advantageous for him to move me out into a less visible position, I guess. Not a lot of media running to the public service commissioner to ask for his opinion.
Might now.
So.
well, and to that end, I mean, do you feel like you owe the governor anything? I mean, the appointment was made. Your interaction with him doesn't have to be any further, I guess.
Yeah, no. I feel very independent in this position. I mean, it's a six-year term, even if I were wanting to be reappointed to it, which is pretty rare, most commissioners are not reappointed. It's kind of a one-term thing. That's 6 years from now. He may not even be governor. I don't see any reason to feel indebted.
Well, and of course, there are those who wonder just how long he will be governor, even in much shorter terms than that. As we already heard, a number of your Republican colleagues, some of your former colleagues, are calling for the governor to resign. Knowing what you know, do you think he should resign?
You know, I think in the time that I've been in office, people have resigned for less. But that's, obviously an intensely personal decision that he will have to make. I don't think having the cloud of scandal helps the party in any way. It certainly doesn't help those that are still in the legislature trying to write law. I think it has damaged his credibility, and it's hard to lead when you have damaged credibility. Not that you can't ever rehabilitate that, and maybe that's what he'll do. But at least in the short term, yeah, it's hard to lead when people don't trust you.
Sounds like if you were still in the Senate, you would be urging the governor to resign.
It's possible.
Fair enough.
Do you have any reaction or surprise at how your GOP colleagues have reacted? Yay or nay?
No, not really. It doesn't surprise me that a handful of members of the House have called for his resignation.
Including some of his big supporters. They don't all have the same relationship with him that Rob Schaff does.
Right, sure. Example. Nate Walker was one of his big supporters during the primary. Marsha Haefner is a very well-respected member of House, particularly in the appropriations process. So is Kathy Conway. It doesn't surprise me that they would come to that conclusion. But again, they also have served under speakers who were forced to resign for less. So,
the harassment of interns, for example.
Yeah, it's not surprising to me that some would come to that conclusion.
Yeah, do you feel? I mean, you worked in the General Assembly in a time when there were those scandals. Before this latest thing happened, did you feel like there was any type of evolution in the Capitol, that things were getting better, that there was something that. Like maybe the cloud that had been over Jefferson City for the last couple of years might have been lifting before this latest incident?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the last couple of scandals that popped up were resolved quickly. I mean, they both, within a matter of hours or days, stepped out and everybody moved on. So it was a shock. I mean, I don't think anybody – I wasn't expecting this to come out about the governor, certainly. So – you know, he'll deal with it how he's going to deal with it, and everyone else will just try to do their job.
Trying to do their job is something that some have said is very difficult right now, but the governor has said he intends to move forward. One of his big priorities is a tax cut plan, what he has called the boldest state tax reform in America. He promised it in his State of the State, said he would release the details early the following week, so now we're about a week past that. We don't have the details, but what we do have is a set of what the governor called principles. He released a press release as well as a 39-second video on Facebook. Ryan, you were one of the leading experts on the state budget during your time in the General Assembly. You chaired the House Budget Committee. I want you to help us make sense of some of what's being proposed here and how it could work out in terms of the state's revenue as well as expenses. But without the specifics, that's difficult to do.
Sure.
Let's listen to at least what the governor said as a starting place for conversation.
Hey, guys. Today, we're laying out the principles of our tax plan. For far too long in Missouri, our tax system benefited special interests. Our plan works for working families. We're going to cut taxes on working families in Missouri. We are also going to lower taxes on businesses to help them to create jobs. We're going to end loopholes, and we're doing all of this in a way that is fiscally sound and does not burden our children with debt. What I'm really proud of is that this plan lowers taxes on 97% of Missourians. That means more money in your pocket, and we look forward to working with all of you to get it done.
Ryan Silvey, is it possible to lower taxes on 97% of Missourians and lower taxes on business and not borrow money and still have the result be, as the governor has said, revenue neutral?
Yeah, without specifics, it's very difficult to analyze that question. I mean, what he's laid out in principles are basically sound bites, which everybody would love to say about any tax plan that they propose. So it's really hard to say. Senator Igel has a plan out there, which is pretty aggressive, restructuring some of the tax brackets, eliminating some of the loopholes. I think there are some loopholes out there, quote unquote loopholes. I mean, we provide incentives for companies to remit taxes on time, for instance.
So, like, they get a 2% tax credit if they pay on time.
Yeah, which is kind of silly because you should pay on time.
It's funny, like, that you get credit for that. Yeah.
Like, we're paying you to follow the law. I mean, that doesn't, So
I used to be a teacher. I mean, you give people credit for turning your paper in on time. Yeah.
Right. But it's still sad.
But do you give,
right.
them, yes. sad. You right. give them extra credit for turning right. it on time? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, so there are some abilities to close some of those things which generate revenue. Now, the overall structure of the plan and whether because you're adding that revenue means you're going to offset a cut somewhere else, you can only discern that once the details are out.
Well, and of course, the underlying assumption behind, as you mentioned, Senator Igel's plan, which focuses on reducing personal income taxes, or
I think he eliminates lowest brackets.
Right,
actually,
he wants to have people under a certain income level not pay taxes at all.
Right.
In Missouri, and he has argued that states that don't have personal income taxes are more financially successful. One of your other colleagues, Senator Andrew Koenig, has a different plan where he wants to cut corporate taxes primarily, say from 6.25% to 4.25%. But both of them have this underlying assumption that cutting taxes is going to lead down the road to growth, that it's going to promote jobs, it's going to raise revenues overall in the long run, which I have to say, you're a Kansas Cityan, that sounds really familiar from the news coverage of Kansas, where that hasn't really worked out.
Yeah, and again, the differences between what we've at least looked at in the past, and I don't know how this debate will ultimately flesh out, but whether you make large cuts at once or whether you make small cuts incrementally tends to be the difference between how Missouri and Kansas have handled it. Kansas has made large cuts all at once. In the tax plans that we've debated and passed, in fact, one of them is a phase-in of 0.1% for every $150 million of increased general revenue. That, to me, seems like a more circumspect plan. Basically, prove it. If cutting taxes increases revenue, then we will do it incrementally as the revenue increases. That's probably where I fall as far as being a fan of tax reform. But to just say cutting taxes increases revenue, it's probably more complicated than that. You probably have to, it probably has to be cutting the right taxes, the right amount at the right time will increase revenue.
Is there a chance that you would, I think, want to see maybe a little bit of assessment of how those do before adding new tax cuts?
I would, as a policymaker. But again, if you're looking at what Senator Igel has proposed, it is not just a tax cut. It is a full-on restructure of the tax code. As you said, eliminating the bottom two or three brackets for one. So if you're talking about a wholesale restructure, I think that's worthy of consideration. But if it's just we're going to cut taxes again because that's our soundbite and that's what we think people want to hear, I don't think that you should jump right into that.
Well, I guess I want to ask you even more broadly about the long-term impact of anything that right now at this juncture is focusing on reducing revenues, because in the end, you're also going to end up having to talk about reducing spending to keep up with the reducing of revenues. And that's always the conversation in Jefferson City. You were part of those budget committees for all of your years in the General Assembly. And tell me if you think this is true, but it sure seems to me like there are a lot of areas in the state budget where legislators have cut and cut and maybe are having a hard time now finding anywhere else to cut.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, during the last Great Recession that we had, we eliminated most of what would be considered the fluff or the waste, fraud, and abuse, if you want to go back to that soundbite. You know, most of what we're at, particularly in the social programs, I mean, you're dictated based on federal matching programs in a lot of these things. And so if people meet certain qualifications, they qualify for this. And if you participate in the program, you have to put up this money and the feds will put up the other money. So there's not a lot of flexibility.
Yeah, and we're doing the minimum in those areas.
Yeah, and most of them. But CHIP was one of the areas where we actually did far above and beyond.
The Children's Health Insurance Program.
The Children's Health Insurance Program was one of the areas that Missouri kind of led the way on providing coverage. But now we're in the situation where the feds may be eliminating that program. So that will create new pressures on the budget if that federal funding goes away.
And I mean, you may have seen this, but the Missouri Times reported that Governor Greitens' office has sent emails to the department heads, his cabinet heads, saying, you know, we anticipate $300 million more in potential cuts. I mean, what impact would that potential size of a cut or slashing do to the budget?
So, I mean, I guess it really it's going to depend on how they apply it. I mean, if the federal matching funds for CHIP go away and they say we're just not going to do CHIP, well then that's where a chunk of that $300 million would come from, and we would no longer be providing the Children's Health Insurance Program. If he's asking departments to make cuts so that we can shift those cuts over to fund what was the federal portion of CHIP, well, then that's a whole other discussion. I don't know what his intent is. The way that our budget is made up, it roughly breaks out into thirds, pretty equal parts. A third of it is education, both elementary and secondary and higher education. A third of it is social services, primarily made up of Medicaid. And then a third of it is literally everything else. I mean, prisons, Department of Revenue, roads. I mean, it's all in that other third. So when you look at how much of each third is made up of general revenue and how much is made up of federal revenue or other funds, education is the one that's all general revenue. We don't get a lot of federal funds for that. We don't get a lot of other dedicated funds for that other than the lottery. And so that's where those cuts usually end up coming from. It pits Medicaid versus education almost every time. I mean, unless you're going to close a prison, which nobody really is out there saying, hey, we should close prisons because of budget cuts. Like, that's not going to be popular.
Well, and that's isn't that the problem, that no cut is popular? Every program has its people who defend it and who would argue it's absolutely essential to what the state's about.
Sure. When you serve on the Appropriations Committee, you find out that everybody's program is the most important thing to them.
So now that you don't have to make this decision, maybe this frees you to speak honestly about a couple of things. I mean, let's say three, because you always held back so much.
I love that lead-in, right?
So, I mean, let's say you get a budget and you're going to have to cut $300 million from it, from the current level of spending. Where would you look first? What makes the most sense?
Probably the way that I would look at it is which federal matching programs would
can we let go of?
Yeah. Which, you know, for instance, if the state puts in a dollar and the feds put in three, and you cut that dollar, that's a total cut of $4, right? If we're in a matching program where we put in a dollar and they put in a dollar, then that's a cut of $2. And so figuring out how to do the least harm is...
So what are some of the federal programs that come to mind that would be on that potential chopping block?
You know, restructuring Medicaid is something that we need to do, and they've not had the appetite to do it. But you could restructure Medicaid, given if you provided a plan to the federal government, to CMS, and they were to give you a waiver. There are a number of things you could do to realize savings there. But until they're willing to have that conversation, I think that most of the cuts will probably be driven back to education, just because that's, for lack of a better word, less work. I mean, it's all general revenue over there.
Education, can it afford any more cuts, either higher education or K-12?
I mean, nobody likes to cut education, but from a constitutional standpoint, Missouri is overfunded on elementary and secondary education. Now, to the classroom teacher, that's not something that they're going to want to agree with or listen to, but the Constitution requires that we give, 25% of general revenue to elementary and secondary, to free public schools, I think is how the Constitution reads. And we're around 35 to 39% of that. So we're way above what the Constitution says, which is why we don't have the Kansas problem of the courts telling us we have to put more money in all the time. But is cutting education what's best for kids in the future? Probably not.
Well, how do you anticipate or see the just passed federal tax cuts affecting Missouri's budget situation? And also, we should say you do now sit on the Public Service Commission. So how will that also affect utilities?
Sure. So that's something in my new capacity that we're actually talking about for the last 2 weeks. Because of the corporate tax cut, we are interested in making sure that those savings don't go directly to stockholders, that those savings go directly to ratepayers. And so we are directing the companies to give us plans on how they intend to refund the rate base on those tax cuts. We have a pending rate case right now where all of the testimony and evidence was in before the tax cut bill passed, but we still haven't made the final rate determination. So we issued an order last week to basically reopen that portion so that we can consider the tax cut.
I believe you want them to get you those plans by the end of this month.
Yes.
Or pretty soon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because we're interested in making sure that those savings are passed on to the ratepayer, not just going into the stock price,
right,
basically. I got distracted then.
The impact on the budget, so, by the federal tax cuts.
So that still remains to be seen. We have our state taxes are coupled with federal taxes, and we have deductibility of federal taxes against your state taxes under the current statute. So the question really is, and there's multiple predictions out there, but how much is that going to cost us? Early estimates were it could cost up to $1 billion. Now those estimates have been revised down to, I think, 50 million.
It's quite a range.
There's really no way to know until the end of the fiscal year on who was right. If they build their budget based on 50 million, and it turns out to be a billion, then the governor's going to have a lot of withholds to have to make.
Which I've always thought is an interesting part of Missouri's budgeting process, because the governor seems to have to withhold more often than he doesn't. And essentially, it lets legislators pass off some of the hardest decisions to the governor.
You know, during the previous administration, Governor Nixon liked to withhold even when he didn't need to. And that was a way of the governor exercising more appropriations control than the legislature. And so I don't know that he always needed to. I think he did it because he wanted to. If we were funding things that he didn't think were priorities, he would just withhold them.
On the theory that you didn't know if the revenues were going to come through yet, so he waited.
So there were a couple of court cases throughout that. But basically, the Constitution says he can withhold to balance the funds if the money's not there, or in the same clause, he also has the ability to, quote, control the flow of appropriation. And so what he ended up doing towards the end of his tenure was, if he didn't like something, he would withhold it. And if he was challenged on it, he just said, well, I'm controlling the flow, and the flow is currently zero. And, you know, so that was a way for him to essentially exercise a veto without having the check of us being able to override the veto. It'll be different, hopefully, with this governor. I would hope that he wouldn't be that confrontational with the legislature controlled by his own party, but we'll see.
I do want to ask you about something else. We are, as of this weekend, 1 year into the Trump presidency. From the perspective that you have, how do you think the presidency of Donald Trump has changed the political culture and reality of Missouri?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think that his effect on politics in general has been that everything now is somewhat like a reality show. And everything is so shocking and everyone is so outraged until the next outrage. And there's always another outrage that it's kind of just so much noise that I think people lose sight of what the government is, what the government's supposed to be doing, what the government is doing. And they're so distracted. I think that's it. I think everybody in politics right now is so distracted, not necessarily just by the president, but by everything. I mean, everybody's just constantly in an outrage.
Does that change the outcomes? Are we getting different laws? Are people's lives being affected because of that shift in the culture?
You know, I don't know if that's something new within the last year just because of Donald Trump, but I would say that in the time that I was in office, the rise of social media certainly affected that. The ability to directly get your message out to whatever supporters you've identified via social media. And then also the ability of people to give instantaneous feedback via social media. And so there kind of gets to be these echo chambers around politics of people only listening to people who agree with them and outraged at the people who don't agree with them. And that maybe perhaps led to the rise of Donald Trump more so than is a byproduct of it.
Did that play a part in your decision to step out of the Senate and go to the Public Service Commission, the state of politics?
I mean, it's certainly not something that's not one of the parts I'm going to miss. You know, and I've said this on this program before, but as a person, tolerated politics so that I could write the policy. I got interested in politics via debate and problem solving, and you know, I wanted to write the policy, and that's how you do it: is you engage in politics to get to that position. But I'm not going to miss that. I will be much happier, I think, in this role because it's a policy role that doesn't have all of that coming with it. Like nobody's really griping at the public service commissioner about the state of politics. I mean, for the most part,
forgive me. I feel like I ought to know more than I do about the Public Service Commission, but I mean, is it a very political body? Do you have divided votes that are left and right in nature?
So it doesn't appear to be.
In your 2 weeks of experience,
right.
Yes.
Right. Now, it is it's a five-person body, and it's divided. You are a Republican or a Democrat, and so I replaced a Democrat, which now gives us three Republicans and two Democrats. But I have not seen the partisanship at all play into that. One of the – and again, I mentioned before, four of this commissioners are former senators, and they basically told me that they felt like the operation of the commission was much more like the old Senate, where, again, partisanship didn't matter. Once you're there, you're there, and now it's a battle of ideas. And it seems like that's the case. I mean, there are times when, in the two brief meetings, public meetings that I've been a part of, where, you know, one member who was taking a position on a contested issue, maybe not where you would expect them to if you just looked at their label. And there doesn't seem to be fighting. It doesn't seem to be like the three Republicans ganging up on the two Democrats at all. In fact, the chairman is a Democrat. even though there's only two Democrats on the commission.
But he was appointed during Governor Nixon's tenure.
Right, and he hasn't been replaced, and Governor Greitens hasn't named a new chairman. So, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of friction within the commission that he's still the chairman.
Well, be careful. I think people would have said what you're saying about the Public Service Commission about the Missouri State Board of Education 6 months ago.
Yeah, the fair.
I mean, is there any chance that it could become politicized like that?
Well, okay. So my understanding was that there were a number of expired terms on the
Missouri State Board of
Education. Yeah. So in my opinion, that was Governor Nixon's neglect that led to that. Right. Had everybody been up to speed and appointed to the terms as they were supposed to, there wouldn't have been an opportunity for a wholesale shift in the commission like that.
And that your point would be confirmed by some of the Democratic appointees to the State Board of Education who expected to be reappointed before the end of Governor Nixon's term, but weren't, and then they were left high and dry.
Right, and you know, my understanding is that on the Public Service Commission, on I think perhaps even the Tax Commission, the Parole Board, they don't really let people go for long periods on an expired term to create that situation.
There's a lot of money riding on the decisions that your commission makes from the utility standpoint.
Sure, and from the ratepayer standpoint.
Right. So one other question about politics. You have mentioned here that you sort of put up with the politics to be able to write policy. Is that a permanent move away from the elected realm? Obviously, your political future was a frequent source of water cooler conversation around the state. You were talked about for the Kansas City Council, maybe for mayor. That's obviously all on hold this time around.
Sure.
Is that something you might still consider someday?
Yeah, I mean, certainly down the road, it might be a consideration. But it's not a plan. You know, I frankly never really had a plan. When I got to the House, I could look out far enough to see that my senator was going to term limit the same time I was. That was probably the closest to a plan that I ever had. Yeah, I mean, if the opportunity to serve was right and it was something that looked interesting to me, I would never rule it out in the future.
But not in 2019?
No, not in 2019.
All right. There you have it. It's official. My thanks to KCUR's Kyle Palmer for being here.
No, thank you. No problem.
And, of course, thanks to Public Service Commissioner, former senator, former state representative, but now 6 years ahead of him in the Public Service Commission, Ryan Silvey. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Statehouse Blend is a production of KCUR Studios. We've had help this week from Chris Young. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at PTSBrian. If you don't already subscribe, please do that wherever you get your podcasts and review us. Also, don't forget to listen every week to an excerpt of our show on the air. You can hear Ryan Silvey's pick for a song that captures this moment in Missouri politics. That's Tuesdays at 11 on KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.